The seven deadly sins. We moved all the way up through this Mount Purgatory and trying to name these sins, trying to make sense of it. And a lot of them seem to overlap. A lot of them seem to be very similar. But the analogy that we used on the next slide is the idea of a black diamond, where you've got different angles into the same darkness, into the same thing itself. So that's what these respective sins try to do, try to make sense of the human condition. So the first one that we looked at is pride being the sin of sins, right? Best exemplified by the accuser, by Satan himself, when he says, if you eat of this tree, you will be like God. You will be like God. And then it's so beautiful and so poetic that the angel that is tasked to fight Satan is Michael, the archangel Michael. And his name in Hebrew literally means who is like God. So Satan says, you can be like God. And Michael taunts him almost just by virtue of being himself. He says, who is like God? And we spoke about humility and the fact that the word humility comes from the word humus, which means earth. So we need to be closer to reality. We need to be more grounded. And that's how we counter pride. We looked at envy and this quite chilling quote from a lady who said, when a friend of mine succeeds, something in me dies. When a friend of mine succeeds, something in me dies. And some of us who are honest, we're willing to admit that, yeah, maybe there's something that we can identify with. And the way that we combat envy is through admiration, through praise, by praising that particular person that we are envious of, expressing admiration about that person, whether publicly or to this person in person. Daniel last week spoke about wrath, this desire for vengeance. And man, if there is something that captures our modern society, it is wrath, isn't it? I mean, if you just think, if somebody does something stupid, then everybody's on social media and we just need to scapegoat this person and just put them on a cross and shout, crucify him, crucify him. That's how we operate today. We've got this love for vengeance, whether it's on the left wing or on the right wing. Wrath. And how do we counter that? Forgiveness. Forgiveness is the counter lively virtue of that. Spoke about sloth. Sloth being the laziness of the soul. And we counter that through zeal, through a sense of mission. Gluttony, an immoderate desire for food and drink. And we counter that with fasting or asceticism. And then lust. We also spoke about lust. Lust is you treating another person as a means to physical pleasure. And the way that you counteract that is through chastity. All right, so now, tonight, we come to greed. Now, what makes greed interesting is the fact that I've been in cell groups for a long time, and people will, once they get to know each other, they will confess certain sins to each other. And I've been in many cell groups where somebody would say, look, I had an explosion of rage this past week, and I'm so embarrassed. It was at work, or it was in the family, or it was road rage, and I really feel ashamed. And please pray for me that I can get a grip on this thing. People will confess that. You've heard confessions like that, or similar versions, versions of that, or somebody will confess that they struggle with lust. That is something that I've heard in my time being in various Christian communities. People will say, look, I don't really want to do Bible study. I don't really care about this. There's not really a yearning for me to pursue God. I've heard that many times. People struggle with pride. People struggle with gluttony, maybe to a lesser extent. I haven't heard a lot of that, with envy, etc. But I've almost never heard somebody confess to a group by saying, I think I'm too materialistic. Have you ever heard it? Somebody saying, I think I am really struggling with greed. It's not something that you hear that often. So in Christian circles, you'll hear all of these other sins being confessed, but never greed, or very seldom at least greed. Now that is interesting, and I think it says something about how greed works, because it's very clever at hiding itself. Because nobody thinks that they've got an issue with greed, right? So the fact that we confess our problem with lust means that we struggle with this. The fact that we confess anger and all of these things implies that we struggle with them. But we never confess greed because, well, we don't struggle with it. Which is so ironic because, just a little bit of reflection, you will notice that it's either your first or your second word. It's a toss-up between mama and mine. Right? So just spend time with some toddlers. You will hear that word constantly. It's our first word. We want stuff. I want that toy. I want that thing. I want that friend. I want that food. I want my mama. Now I want my daddy. Now I want somebody else. But the point is, it's mine. So it's interesting that we do not identify this as a problem, that we don't think that this is something that we might be wrestling with. And it's so funny because Jesus spoke more about money than about gluttony, about lust, about pride, about wrath, about sloth, about envy. He spoke more about money than any of those things. And maybe the reason why he emphasized it a lot, maybe the reason why he preached on it so much, is because of this ability of greed to hide. Look, I mean, if I spoke about money as often as Jesus did, then, I mean, this is already pretty empty, but it would be much more empty. Is that it? Then if I did speak about money all the time. But Jesus spoke about money all the time. And yes, like I said, he realizes that it hides itself. Because if you think about it, when you cheat on someone, then you know that you're cheating on someone, right? It's something that is quite obvious. You know that this is not your girlfriend or this is not your wife, all right? If you've got a burst of road rage and you're shouting at everybody, then you know, okay, maybe there's a bit of anger issues. But greed hides itself. And it hides itself with words like, he is doing well, she's doing well for herself, or he is very successful. Greed hides in terms like that. Or, you know, you don't want to struggle one day. Or, you know, you just must be secure. You know, you must be careful with your money. You must be secure one day. That's how greed works. Let's just look at those. Successful. If somebody says, you know what, that person is very successful, then it is a shame that our culture is such that we don't question that. Like, successful at what? Like, you just made a random statement. You just said you're successful. Are you a successful mother? Are you a successful friend? Are you successfully kind to other people? What does success mean? So if somebody says that person is successful, I think we can probe them. Successful at what? What else? If somebody says that person is doing well for himself, I've said this before, but whenever I hear that, when I ask about a friend, how's that guy doing? And then I say, no, he's doing really well for himself. And then I've trained myself to have this knee-jerk reaction of, oh, that's so sad. I'm sorry to hear that. And then they say, what do you mean? I said, no, it's just sad that he's doing well for himself and not for others. I'm really sad to hear that. No, I mean he's doing financially well. Oh, so you mean he's doing financially well. Okay, no, that makes sense. Just add so that I can understand what you are referring to. So when people say he's doing well for himself, why does that automatically mean financially? I think that's problematic. Or something like, you must just be secure. You must just be secure one day. Think of all the advertisements that is always pushing this. Are you taking care of your future, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, let's just examine that last bit of, you know, you must just make sure that there's a certain degree of security. I mean, maybe I'm getting a little bit too philosophical here, but we are, as far as I understand, a little bit of science that I understand, a speck of dust floating in a very aggressive universe. And you've got usable energy that is being used up, and this universe can, or at least our planet, can very easily run out of usable energy, and it's a miracle that we're not, and we can look at political ramifications, we can look at all of these forces, and you think that you just saving for your retirement one day, that is security. I don't think it's that easy. Or if that doesn't happen, one day there is a trap door that's going to swallow us all, right? You're going to die. So you're going to stand in front of your nice house, your dream house, and you're going to stand on your manicured lawn and you're going to have a heart attack. Okay, I know this sounds pretty grim, but the point is that all the security in the world does not really help with that kind of thing. So when people say you need to make sure about security, I think we've got this false sense of being the masters of our own destiny when there are so many things that we are entirely dependent on things that's definitely not financial. So a passage that looks at this and deals with this is in Luke 12. I mean, there are many passages, but Luke 12 is the one that I want to look at. And this comes from verses 13 to 21. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God." Now, what's interesting about this passage, let me just give you a bit of culture, I'm not going to start singing, a bit of cultural background. Man, I'm struggling today. Thanks, thank you. A bit of cultural background. So when somebody like this, when somebody said, please tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me, that is sort of a weird thing, and I will be somewhat surprised if one of you just pop out here, put up your hand and say, "Look, I've got this issue, please tell my brother to share this with me," or whatever. But that wasn't necessarily strange in that era, because people approached rabbis all the time and asked them to give them an opinion on law. So they were not only religious teachers, but teachers of the law as well. They didn't have a distinction like we do. So it wasn't completely strange to have that sort of request. But when Jesus responds, just notice that he says, "Man, who made me an arbiter between you?" That is not a nice way of responding to someone. That is very dismissive. It is, Jesus is visibly annoyed when this guy asks him this question. And the reason for that is this. Jesus is not interested in doing something that will secure a broken relationship between these two brothers. He's not interested in that at all, because the language that this guy is using is the same sort of language that we read in the prodigal son. So when the prodigal son says, "Dad, give me my inheritance," then he's gone. That's the end of that relationship. So when he's asking for his share of the inheritance, that means a broken relationship, and Jesus is not interested in that kind of thing. So Jesus says, "Look, I'm really not interested in that kind of thing." And then he tells them this parable, and this parable is brilliant, because it tells the story of this rich fool. But one thing that's very interesting is how often we see the word "I" and "he." So, for example, then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus again. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" Do you notice how this guy's talking to himself? "I will say to myself, self, let's do this, and then I will do this." And then he's having a conversation with himself, and that is so tragic, especially in the Middle Eastern culture. I mean, we are more individualistic today, but in the Middle Eastern culture, you made all these sorts of decisions within community. That was not something that you did by yourself. Yet this guy is talking to himself, and that is something that money does. Money isolates us. Money has a tendency. Greed has a tendency to isolate us. If you've ever, I'm not sure if you know really rich people, which is maybe part of the problem, because we all know rich people or richer people, so we never think we are rich, all right? So we don't think that this applies to us. That's maybe why you guys are saying, "Okay, let's hear," because the rich people really need to hear the sermon. If that's your attitude, then I think you're missing the point, but we'll get to that in a bit. I lost my train of thought now. Rich. Oh yeah. If you ask any person who's really rich, then they will tell you, if they are vulnerable enough, that it's very difficult to know who your friends are. Does that make sense? It's very difficult to know whether this relationship is anything but a means to an end. So you're constantly paranoid whether these are true friendships or whether this is just this person networking. You never know how to make sense of it, and it's quite tragic to see people struggle with this. And that is what money does. It isolates you. If you don't believe me, go read some of the quotes from these multimillionaires throughout history. When they say that it's a very, very lonely place. All right. So this fool, on the one hand, is isolated. So it's a tragic story. But it's also foolish. The idea that he's got this sense of security. Now I've got enough. And this guy's working himself to death, and now he's going to enjoy his retirement, and boom, he dies. Now, the point that Jesus is making here is that your security is stupid, and we need to have a very real sense of our mortality in front of us. What's also interesting about this passage is that Jesus deliberately uses economic terms to... So he's almost humoring this guy and saying, okay, well, I know you're this economist and you love making money and making and having as much stuff as you possibly can. So let me indulge you with an economic term. Today, I demand your life from you. So he's using an economic term that would translate to something like, today I'm going to take back the loan that I gave you, the loan of your life, and I'm going to take it back. The creditor is now claiming back his loan. So he's almost sticking with the economic terminology. And it's just really important to know that this sense of security is silly. Job understood this. In Job 1 verse 21, he says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He understood this dynamic. Something else that's security. The other thing about greed is that it is continually shifting the goalposts. We can often think, if I can just have that thing, then I will be happy. If I can just get that thing, that's all I want. I don't want much. I just want that, and then everything will fall into place. And then as soon as you get it, the goalposts just shift again. So I had a bit of a obsession with a girl in high school, and man, I prayed a lot for not for her well-being, but for my acquirement of her. And it was constantly, if I can just have God, I'm not asking for much, you know. I don't want to be ducks learner, right? I don't want to be head boy. I don't want to be any of those things. I just want this girl. That's not a, like, I'm not driving a hard bargain here. And years later, when I stopped praying, which is maybe not a good argument for the case of prayer, for the, what do you call it, the power of prayer, this lady, this girl, we dated. And man, what an anticlimax was that. Because now I was like this Jack Russell who caught up with the bus and didn't really know what to do with this bus. And this poor girl could never compete with my obsession. You know, I put her on this pedestal. She would never be able to compete against 2 years of, I don't know, fantasizing that she is rainbows and sunshine and everything. And what I realized is that I don't think I really wanted her, but I wanted possession of her. Like I wanted her to be my girlfriend, but I didn't really want her. I'm not sure if that distinction makes any sense, because when I had her as my girlfriend, then it was a little bit like when you go shopping, and the product will be very, very valuable, but then when you buy it and you just break the plastic, then the value of it significantly decreases, right? So now this item is not valuable anymore. And then whilst I've bought this new girlfriend for myself, I think, okay, well, Lord, remember when I said that if I can have her, it'll be enough. I've got one more thing that I want. I think I also need this and this and this. That is how greed works. There's never an end game. There's always something else. It's really a case of never being enough. Now, I want to do some groundbreaking cultural analysis here. Talking about critically acclaimed movies. Whom of you have seen the movie The Greatest Showman? Okay, some of you. Well done. Now, it's this very poppy musical sing-along. It's like High School Musical for almost adults. And I really enjoyed it. So I'm just, confession time, I really enjoyed The Greatest Showman. And then when I read what the critics said about it, I thought, ah, well, you know what? I'm just going to take this one for the team. I still enjoyed it a lot. But it's basically a story of this guy, P.T. Barnum. It's based on true characters, but they obviously play with it. And he goes from rags to riches, starts small, and then he's in love with this girl from his youth. And you can almost see in him, if he can only take care of her, that's his only dream. He just wants her, he wants a family with her, and he just wants to take care of her, then everything will be okay. And then he gets her, all right? And they've got a lovely family, but things are economically a little bit unstable. And then he decides to start a circus, all right? And he starts a circus, and it's quite successful. He gathers all of his people and animals and mixtures between them, and they have their whole their thing, their circus. And then he's rich. He's doing well for himself, as they say. He is successful at that stage, but he still cannot access the bourgeoisie crowd. They still reject him. The upper class, if you will. So he still cannot access them. And because, I mean, it's a circus. You're not going to have this critically acclaimed review of a circus. So he then decides to get this lady, the Swedish Nightingale, they called it, Jenny Lind, to do a tour of America. And now he's in these opera houses with her, and she's performing. And finally, he gets the recognition that he craves so much. And the moment just before that happened, well, this is actually the moment in which it happened. So I just quickly want to show you this video. So if you haven't seen the movie, I mean, the plot is not that important, so I can just tell you what's going on. So there's nothing like a spoiler alert. It's just a sing-along. And the spoiler is this, that this guy is now a little bit infatuated with this lady. All right, she stunned the crowd, she stunned him, and you have that scene where the wife is a little bit worried, seeing that there's a bit of a triangle developing here. But he's got his eyes on her, he's now infatuated with her, but he's also infatuated with the critic who's sitting there, and this critic must just give me a good review. It must just, so that I can finally break into this aristocratic bourgeois crowd. If I can just do that, then everything will be okay. Now, it doesn't end that bad. So he remains a family man, and he loses everything, but he gains everything. So he sort of goes back, and he realizes that he should be content with what he had. So that's sort of the premise of the story. But this song that we all love, and a lot of people know this song, is probably the theme song for greed, if you think about it. I know it sounds lovely, and this girl is very lovely when she sings it, but it's a very problematic song. And it's very good that he didn't succumb to her seduction, because he just had to listen to the lyrics of this song to know that this romance is not going to last very long. All the shine of 1,000 spotlights, all the stars we steal from the night sky, will never be enough, will never be enough. Towers of gold are still too little. These hands could hold the world, but it'll never be enough, never be enough, never be enough for me. Never be enough, never be enough, never be enough for me. So yes, it'll be lovely if I can have her, or it'll be lovely if I can have him, but it will never be enough. The goalposts will shift again. So how do we counter this? How do we counter this greed that is constantly shifting the goalpost, that hides itself so well? We counter it through generosity, through charity. That's how we counter greed. Now, some of you say, Johan, I've got this. I tithe. I'm a tither, so don't worry about me. We can go home early. Not quite. So one thing that's very interesting is that a conversation that I've had with many of my friends is tithing. By the way, is it, do I tithe on the gross or on the net income? Like, where exactly do we tithe? And if you ask that question, you already don't get it. Okay, you're struggling a little bit with how this Christianity thing works. Yes, there's a thing of 10%. You give it to the Levites. That's the Old Testament recommendation, and it's fine. But bad news: the New Testament does not give you a number. It does not give you a number. Only gives you a person, Jesus. And it says, I want you to give as Jesus gave. In other words, you must give sacrificially. Now that's not a number, but it's bad news, right? Because the model that we have for giving is the same model that we have for everything. So the model that Jesus gave us in our relationships with each other is the same economic model that he gave us. We should give sacrificially. Now, there's a good story that helps to illustrate this problem, how we relate to this, how we do our tithing. So there was a farmer, and he had a very good season. He farms sheep, had a very good season, and covered all of his expenses, and he's good. This is a few years ago. And the next moment he looks at one of his sheep and he realizes she's pregnant. And this is a bonus because it's out of season. He's paid most of his expenses. So whatever's going to come out of this lady sheep is going to be just a bonus. And then, to his utter amazement, she gives birth to twins. Now there are two little lambs over there. And he is just amazed at what's happened. And he goes to his wife and he says, you know what, we are so blessed on this farm. This has been an incredible season. We are so blessed. And you know what I want to do? I want to really give one of the income from one of these lambs. I want to give it to God because he's blessed us, and I really just want to give it to God. And for the other one, I thought we can maybe just spoil ourselves, maybe with the television, maybe with something that we don't have. Just it's extra, so let's just spoil ourselves. And the wife said, "Wow, how spiritual, wonderful, that this is what you want to do." A few days later, the guy comes back, and he's very distraught, very unhappy. He says, "My wife, I've got horrible news." She says, "What?" He says, "The Lord's lamb died." The Lord's lamb died. And the wife said, I didn't realize that we assigned the lambs. This is the TV lamb, and this is the Lord's lamb." No, I did. Unfortunately, like from the beginning, I said, "Lord's lamb, TV lamb." And it's really the Lord's lamb that died. It's so tragic. Well, the moral of the story is this. It's always the Lord's lamb that dies. It's always his lamb that dies. So we never give from a place of we give from a place of excess. We never give from a place of obedience. So when we've covered our expenses, when we've spent money on our luxuries, then we will give to God. You know, I've been so blessed. Let me give something to God. But when that blessing is revoked, when you are struggling that month, then God's lamb died in that particular instance. C.S. Lewis reflects on this as well. He says the following: "I do not believe one can settle how much we ought to give. I'm afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. In other words, if our expenditure on comforts, luxuries, amusements, etc., is up to the standard common among those with the same income as our own, we are probably giving away too little. If our charities do not at all pinch or hamper us, I should say they are too small. There ought to be things we should like to do and cannot do because our charitable expenditure excludes them." Now, to translate that, the way in which we should give, in which we should tithe, is not a percentage. It should hurt. That is the rule that is given. You must give so that it hurts. There must be something that you want to do and you cannot do because you gave that money away. So whether it's some sort of, whether it's a massage that you really wanted to do but you can't, now you need to scratch it off the list because you gave, then you are more or less in a good space. And it's not a bad way of approaching this thing, by the way, to think of what are the things that I would like to do, what are some of the luxuries that I would like to spoil myself with, and then to deliberately scratch them off the list and say, how much does that cost? Okay, well, that's how much I'm going to give extra this month so that I can feel it in this or that way. So I know this is very difficult, but this is what it means when you give sacrificially. You give from your first fruits. But there's something sacramental, something very spiritual that happens when we do this. You are declaring when you give your money away that you are ultimately dependent on God. You are declaring somewhere that you have confidence in God, not confidence in the bank, not confidence in yourself to ultimately take care of you. You have confidence in God. So it's almost a religious ceremony, a religious sacrament of sorts when you give. And it's very healthy for us spiritually and psychologically. King David understood this in 1 Chronicles 29. He says this: "But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this?" What an awesome line, by the way. So for him, he turns it around. He switches it. So for him, it's not the luxuries that we spend, and if something is left, then we can give it to God. So the first thing that he wants to do is, I want to really give this to God. And he's excited about it. He says, "Just who am I? And who are my people that we are blessed to give?" I remember doing fundraising for a particular event, and I asked this one guy, and he gave a lot of money, and I was about to do the typical thing of, "Oh, thank you so much, God bless you, blah blah blah," and he just interrupted me and said, "Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity to give." really, thank you for approaching me with the opportunity to give. I really appreciate it. He thanked me for the fact that he could give to this particular project. I think he understood this. But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? And it's because David understood how it works. Everything comes from you, and we have given you only what comes from your hand. They understood that it was never their house to begin with, never their car to begin with. It's the Lord's car. It's the Lord's house. It's just a loan. And we need to keep that in mind when we how we use this particular loan. In Isaiah 53, I don't have it on the slide, but there's this beautiful line where it just prophetically says, Jesus saw his suffering, his future suffering, and he was satisfied. He saw his suffering and he was satisfied, which is such a weird paradox, but that is the Christian paradox. That it's the joy of giving. Because the more you give, the more you receive. The more you humble yourself, the more you will be exalted. So something that we don't understand always is that when Jesus tells us to give sacrificially, it is not because he needs the money, because everything is his in any case. But it's good for us when we do that. It's good for us to get into that frame of mind. He offers us freedom. Because something that I often do, I like to judge rich people, right? So when I drive through Waterkloof or Waterkloof or some of these other suburbs, then I say, it's like, who can live like this? I mean, it's just too much. Like, and if somebody drives a very fancy car, then there's immediately something judgmental in me. And you know what? It means money still has a grip on me. Greed still has a grip on me. It still affects me. The fact that I can respond in that way. If you hate rich people, then it means that money still has a grip on you. And greed, you are still affected by greed. Likewise, if you are middle class and you treat the poor in a patronizing way, you speak down on them, you don't think that you can learn anything from them, it means that greed still has an effect on you. You know why? Because you are trying to ascribe this person's value and what you can learn from them based on their economic profile. It means that you are still thinking in financial terms. You are still the guy who's saying he is successful or she is successful, and you only think economically. So don't think that greed is something that exists outside of us. It doesn't work like that. And also the other thing that I said earlier is that no one is rich today. No one is rich. Probably the richest people I know, we visit them often, and we go to this massive house in this very wealthy suburb, and we eat this prime steak with this like boutique Weber, and like everything is rich and fancy and whatever. And then when it comes to the table talk, what do these people say? Yesterday we spent time with these people. They are so rich. They are like really rich. And I think, dude, you're really rich. But the point is that those people don't think that they're rich because they know people who are richer than them. And the irony is that the people who are richer than them, when they go to supper with people like me, they talk about these people that they visited who are really rich. Okay, and those people with their 15 helicopters, they tell other people, you know what, we spent time with this guy and he was really, really rich. The point is, we're always comparing ourselves. Nobody thinks that they are rich because we all know somebody who's richer than us. So we never think that this is a problem for us. It's very problematic. We must be very careful of how this affects us and how it works. So I've got some homework for you. And the homework is this. I want you to spend some money on a pleasure. Some of you are saying, done, okay, I've got this. I'm willing to do this. I like this church. I want you to spend money on something that is pleasurable, all right? But then I want you to journal about it. I want you to write what it meant to you, what you can remember of this thing, how it affects your thinking from now on or whatever, really try and write about it. Whether it's golf, whether it's a massage, whether it's whatever is the nail thing or whatever is the feet thing, you can do that and then write about it, journal about it. And then I want you to do two philanthropic things. Okay, I want you to give sacrificially, not only with your money, but also with your time. Okay, and we've got lots of opportunities to help you to find an adequate place. And I want you to write about it. I want you to journal about it. And I'm just going to leave that there. Okay, I'm not going to tell you what the outcome is going to be like. But I really want you to do that. And it's not a trick. I mean, you guys do, like the fun stuff that you in any case are going to do, I just want you to write something about it. And then I want you to intentionally do something else that is going to be more sacrificial, more philanthropic, if you will. And I want you to write about it as well. That's the homework. All right. And I will be checking this. The last thing, and I'm going to end with this. when it comes to the power of greed and how it operates and how it manages everything, the one thing that really gives us perspective in this life is death. Death helps us a lot to gain perspective, because we spend our lives looking at these magazines, looking at Forbes, you know, the Forbes list of who's the richest right now, or you just walk past a magazine shelf and you look at all these attractive people, and then a lot of these stories are, Katy Perry just bought a new mansion, or a new dog with diamond feet, or all of these extravagant little things, and we look at it for some reason. We buy the magazines, we read these articles, or these stupid pop-up ads. I'm not sure if it's just because I'm, if it's my computer or whatever, but it's always like this guy in Centurion. Then they look like they are Canadian. That person has never been in the South African sun. It says this person in Centurion is making 1,500 rand per 30 seconds, and that's constantly what we are what we are getting. And it's so funny that when somebody dies and you go to a funeral, that I've never been to a funeral where somebody reflects on a guy's life and they say, Jacob was really, really rich. You know, nobody says that. Or if you look at the other things that always fascinate us or we obsess about it, we're like, Kobus had incredible teeth. This girl had an incredible body. You know, nobody says that in the eulogy, because death helps us to get perspective. We know that these things that we spend all of our time with, obsessing about, is ultimately trivial, is ultimately silly in comparison to what is really important. And I think that's something that we need to keep in mind when thinking about how we spend our life and how we spend our money. I want to read you just this quick story, and I'm going to end with this. Just need to find it quickly. This is from John Ortberg. He tells this story. Larry and I had gone to the same college. This is a guy called Larry Clark. When he was in his 30s, he quit his job so that he could serve full-time at the church for no pay. He never married, never owned a home, never went on an expensive vacation. He just befriended people. He saw potential. He invited people into groups, into opportunities to make friends and contribute. He saw potential in discouraged people. He had a radar for lonely people. He told people what he thought they could become. Not long after, Nancy, that is the author's wife, had taken over this ministry. Larry, while at a leadership retreat in Milwaukee, was jogging downtown early in the morning and stepped in front of a bus and was struck and killed. His loss was devastating to that group of leaders, but even they had no idea of his impact. A wake was held for Larry in the chapel of the church that week. No one was sure how many people would come. After all, Larry never married, he had no children, and he didn't have a regular job. Cars came flooding in. The wake lasted 3 hours. So many people came to file past the casket that the line went out the chapel door for blocks. 800 people stood in line for 3 hours to honor him. The next day was a funeral service. The chapel at Willow Creek can hold around 500 people when jammed full. Over the decade or so that we served there, many funerals were held in the chapel, several of them for people of significant stature and achievement. Only one drew so many people that it overflowed the chapel and had to be moved to the main auditorium. Larry Clark's. At the service and the wake, at the reception and in the halls, one person after another spoke of how his or her life had been touched by Larry. None of the stories were about Larry's possessions or achievements. All of them were about Larry's capacity to love. We used to wonder how Larry could afford to give all this time away. Somebody at his funeral mentioned they heard Larry say one time that you'd be surprised how much good food you could find foraging behind Rolf's supermarket that gets thrown out even though it's still packaged and fresh. That same decade, a funeral was held for a man named Armand Hammer. At the age of 92, Hammer was chairman of Occidental Petroleum Company, a billionaire industrialist and philanthropist. He was called by the USA Today a giant of capitalism and a confidant of world leaders. It wasn't until his death that his story came out. Harvard-educated political scientist Edward Epstein wrote a dossier, The Secret History of Armand Hammer, in which he reported that Hammer got his start by laundering money for the Soviet government, that hired ghostwriters to write fictitious autobiographies of his life. He got more money through a string of broken marriages. He allowed his father to go to prison for a botched abortion Hammer himself had performed. He neglected his only son and hid himself from an illegitimate daughter. He had no friends at Occidental, where he fired his top executives as though they were errand boys. When his brother Victor died, he filed a claim of $670,000 against the estate rather than disbursing it to Victor's children and nursing home-bound wife. When Hammer died, his son Julian did not attend the funeral. Neither did the members of his two brothers' family, and neither did almost anyone else. Within days of his death, Occidental distanced itself from him. The company's website doesn't even mention him in its history. His pallbearers were his chauffeur, his male nurse, and other personal employees. One man was famous, courted, wealthy, connected, powerful, envied, and feared. The other man secretly scrounged for food behind a grocery store and was loved. Which one was rich toward God? So what that story helps us with is to understand what is important, to make sense of that. And if we want to get perspective on our money, if we want to get perspective on how to give, then we don't even have to look at this guy. We can only look at Jesus. We can look at the cross. And when you look at the cross, that should teach you and tell you and minister to you how to live relationally, but also how to live economically. Let me pray and then we can go into Q&A. Lord Jesus, I want to thank you for your generous, generous gift, your gift on the cross. Thank you that can overwhelm us. Thank you that can be our motivation, our vision, and something that we constantly hold in front of our eyes and try to follow and try to imitate. Lord, it's very difficult, and money's got a way of getting at us, and we live in a society where we want to buy things that we don't need, and we are constantly reminded of things, and constantly new desires and worries are created that we need to cover. I pray that the church as a whole would be a different type of organism, that it will be a kind of organization that can really sacrifice and follow you sacrificially. I pray that when we talk about our finances, that we would confess and talk about it like we talk about many other sins, that it would not be off limits. And that our giving, our finances, will also reflect the beautiful cross of Christ. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.